Between Two Marketers, episode 2. Who are you and what do you do?
I'm Mads Hallett.
Okay.
I lead our marketing function at Mr. Yum.
Yep.
So we're based here in Melbourne. Mr. Yum came to be in 2018, initially based on the insight that people eat with their eyes and that if they could see photos of the food that they were about to eat and drink, they would spend more and we could help to address the really thin margins facing the hospitality industry.
Yeah, it's funny. Who did I catch up with the other day? One of the owners of Apoca on Raftown mm-hmm. Street, and they were very welcoming of you guys in comparison to others in the industry, let's say. Because I think that you gave them some sort of help during the first lockdown that like really helped them get online. So it was so topical at the time because I was going there to talk to them about what does service mean.
Mm.
And they raised like your brand. There was another as well, but I'm pretty sure it was Mr. Yum at the time that they mentioned.
Yeah, we hear a lot of it, and it's really born by our founders and the people who started the business. The Kim, Carrie, and Adrian are actually from a hospitality background themselves, and so they came in from the startup side uh-huh. and have then been on this journey to educate themselves and embed ourselves in the industry. And that's meant a lot of listening, and we've really come in with no assumptions about how we should be building products for the industry. We listen and then develop our roadmap from there. And in COVID, that meant a really hard pivot. Our business was 100%, you know, dine in, and it was all about QR codes on tables and visual menus and order and pay. That had been going really well before COVID with Australian Venue Co. backing us and starting to work with a lot of venues around the country. But pickup and delivery needed to happen when everyone was locked down. And so it began this evolution of just building exactly what people need, building a discovery page for consumers to buy food and making it feasible from an economics perspective when margins are already really thin.
I personally first came across Mr. Yum after we came out of lockdown. We went to my mate, he's Sri Lankan, we went to a Sri Lankan restaurant, but I thought like, because it was very modern, they had Mr. Yum, I think the thing that you guys have done really well is what Linktree has done well for e-commerce is making things very much mobile. So I just found it, I was like, whoa, this is a whole nother world. This is going to be the future of how we use restaurants and food and so on. Before we get into Mr. Yum properly though, I want to talk about you and your studies. So I know you did Bachelor of Comms at Melbourne Uni, first grad role at Forethought, which was actually an agency, and then working at Fonda. What sort of got you into the marketing space? Like, did you have a career counsellor breathing down your neck at high school or...?
I had a career counsellor putting me into the bracket where I should basically do commerce or law. My sister had done law and I didn't want to do that.
What did your sister say about law?
Look, she was too busy driving down the Monash Freeway to go to Clayton every day and just try to balance 2 degrees.
Yeah.
But I think I saw a path with that. You know, she was my closest influence there and I saw a path that very much had a set job at the end of it. And I don't think leaving school... I felt that. I didn't really have a title that I was going for, but I loved economics at school. I was always really interested in business. And then I knew that it had to be food. It always had to be food. I always wanted to be a chef. I then wanted to be a nutritionist off the back of that. Wanted to be a pastry chef. So I ended up doing the rounds in some pastry kitchens in Melbourne. So I was, you know, zesting lemons next to Adriana Zumbo in my summer holidays. And so degree-wise... It started to be around, okay, how could I get myself a backing with a business degree so that I can make the food thing happen one day? And you don't really meet marketing until you get to uni. You don't get to do marketing in school.
Yeah.
So it was the first exposure.
I had a very similar experience. I remember, I'm just trying to think, because I was obsessed with, I'm just trying to think of what it was Epicure, right? The lift out, you'd always get in the Age on a Tuesday.
Yeah. Oh, good food now. But
it's good food now. Epicure. Yeah. I was obsessed with that. And like the news, the jobs, everything. And so I was doing commerce at Swinburn. And I went through various stages of like, I'm going to become a restaurateur or I'm going to become, like, so the first thing I did was I went to Vudemond and I applied to be an apprentice chef. And I said I was going to be apprentice chef and I was going to study commerce. And they looked at me like, this guy really doesn't get it, does he? he doesn't know.
Lifestyle.
Yeah, he just doesn't understand the lifestyle. And so that quickly fell apart when I was like, okay, this isn't going to work. And then the next proper thing I had was like the wine sommelier thing. And so I remember working at the press club. So I mentioned Apoca because Angie runs Apoca. And eventually though, for me, hospitality, like as a lifestyle, became really, really hard. Just it didn't, for me personally, it didn't align. I still have a lot of friends in that industry though, you know, Greek, Italian background. You're going to have people who work in it. So I was curious, what was the thing that drove you to more of the business side, the marketing side of things, as opposed to, say, becoming a pastry chef?
Very similar to you, I got to see the hours and the lifestyle. Working in Zumbo's kitchen, especially the bakers, which was a 3 a.m. Shift. And so I was so interested in pastry, but that was going to be early morning. And then anything that was around the dinner service was going to be very late nights. And I think I could see early on that I would probably fall out of love with the cooking and the hospitality if that was my routine. Yeah. And so the shift was probably working at Fonda, to be honest. I was part of the team as we were launching venues. And our venue manager at the time, Tim McNamara, really took me under his wing to have more of a, you know, front of house leadership role. And I got to see the business side of a hospitality company and business and the expansion there. That was at the end of high school. And then by second year uni, I was still doing the hospo thing, had taken on a position at Forethought and was also at Uber Eats. So there was an overlap there of three jobs. That was at the beginning of second year uni, and really what rose to the top there was that I'd met Uber at a uni networking event, just wanting to get involved in anything, really. I'd been part of the Commerce Student Society and we'd had all the big banks and the big four in there and Uber was there. I went over actually probably after too many red wines from the open bar at the corporate cocktails event. And I'd seen, you know, that was the time of Uber ice cream and Uber puppies. And I'd seen that there were brand ambassadors involved in that casually. Yeah. And so I left my details with them there.
Yes, Uber puppies and Uber ice cream. Fuck, man, those are the days, man. There was the initial launch of Uber in Australia. I specifically remember the puppies and ice cream thing because I was working at Ibis World, data intelligence company, and everyone's like, oh, what's this Uber thing? I know it's in America, but you're on it. Like, that's so unusual. And then a year later, everyone was on Uber. And I think it was
magic.
And I think a lot of those PR campaigns really pushed that. When you look back at that time that you had it, that may have made you realize how prepared or unprepared you were going into the real world, so to speak?
I always approached uni very vocationally in terms of, you know, its role being to apply those skills and get a job and apply it to work as soon as possible, really. So I think with that approach, I was lucky in many ways that I was supported, you know, by Uber and by my family at the time to be working full-time and doing uni full-time and getting to apply things live. And so in terms of those resources, it was really, I think, just a bit of a frustration and confusion early on about how applicable the things in the classroom were at work. Mm-hmm. And being in, you know, a high growth tech business where you're using, you know, the best tools and have exposure to the best minds, some of those resource gaps were around, you know, the information being outdated in some cases, or, you know, feeling like there was that slight disconnect between the industry I was in and what I was learning in the classroom.
Okay.
And so I think matching that was something I was really aware of. And with people since that you know, I've mentored or spoken to who are in uni, that's often the voice that I can provide around, you know, think about how this gets applied. And that really helped keep me sane in uni when assignments were piling up and you were wondering where it was all leading.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing about uni, right? And to me personally, that's where YouTube has been like amazing. At that age where you don't have the access to someone like yourself or anyone who's really in the industry sometimes, leaning on that as a resource to see what people are using, even if it's learning like what are the majors in a space, whether it's Salesforce or HubSpot mm-hmm. or whatever it may be, that would have been interesting to me at the time, I think. So 9 months at Forethought, Uber Eats. I think during the launch of Uber Eats, you became social and content marketing manager. Yes, for solid 4 or 5 years at Uber. And I know we were talking about the States downstairs. That all culminated in this global marketing operations role. Tell me about, like, why? Because you had the opportunity at Forethought, but then you're also working at Uber Eats. What made you think that brand work versus an agency was better?
So the first week at Uber, I was sitting there. My manager who hired me actually moved to Sydney on my first day, which was memorable. So I was in this office.
Wait, did you know about that?
No, not until my first day. So I'm sitting there, I'm thinking I'm there for, you know, a 2-3 day a week internship and I'm going to learn some stuff. And I vividly remember someone was visiting our office from Canberra and I was introduced as the Melbourne marketing manager on day two. And so really that helped to make my decision. You know, it was a cool environment. We were in Cremorne. There was, you know, table tennis and puppies and free food and this Uber Eats side of the business, which was kind of off in the corner of the office, was piquing my interest. And so a couple of months in, I made the decision to go all in and I left Fonda and left Forethought and was picked up by the APAC head of marketing for Uber Eats to support the launch of Sydney. So Melbourne had launched in about February. Sydney was coming up in June and Melbourne at the time was already the biggest city in the world for Uber Eats on sheer volume.
Yeah.
He was the one, you know, growth marketing person and brought me in to look after our digital channels from there.
Why do you think they selected Melbourne as one of the first cities to open up in?
I think someone gave some very good advice about product market fit. Is really it. You know, before Uber Eats, the product was an instant product where basically a bunch of sandwiches or burritos or bagels were put in the back of a car and jetted around the city at a certain time. And so you would basically like lock in your sandwich or lock in your burrito, it would arrive and that was the magic. The marketplace product that we know Uber Eats to be today was first launched in Melbourne. So that model of actually, you know, picking a geographic area, selling to restaurants, acquiring consumers, getting people to download the app was, you know, first of its kind in Melbourne. And so it was an experiment and it took off.
So the whole McCafe thing reminds me of that.
Yeah.
Do you know that whole story? Like, you know, who was it? I feel like actually it wasn't a Melbourne thing, but it was a franchise owner in like Adelaide pushed the idea of opening a cafe, or they had like a little cafe slot on top of the McDonald's, and McCafe became like a global sensation because of that. When you think about it in hindsight, you spent all this time at Uber. What have you taken from, maybe there's principles, maybe there's certain must-haves that you look at when running any sort of platform, digital platform, let's say. What have you pulled into Mr. Yum today?
The biggest thing I would say is bringing marketing as close to the product, as close to engineering, as close to sales as possible. I think the structures that we had at Uber meant that marketing wasn't top of mind. You weren't in a position where people were dishing you out big budgets and thinking about you all the time and giving you a seat at the table. And so, you know, even very early on at Uber, I identified that yes, my role was in social media and content, but I needed to work with the product teams. I needed to work with the paid media teams to show ROI of every single thing I was doing from the get-go. And so I think the environment there taught me that, and that's something that I think I will always take with me into future roles, alongside scale and operating at scale, having a global lens. And at least thinking through global implications of what you're doing. With a high growth company like Mr. Yum, you know, we want to think of ourselves in that position as someone who is on an international path. And so I find that I'm able to use that voice and experience to speak to, you know, what does this look like when we're in 5 different regions around the world? Mm. You know, how are we setting up our landing pages with language redirects? How are we setting up our ad accounts for different currencies? Like, all of those pieces come very naturally to me. And I think a lot of it is from that global exposure early in my career.
Do you find then that, like, being that in-house person, because let's say when a lot of clients come to us from a social media marketing or digital perspective, the, like I said earlier, we only do strategy first and we sit down with them, and they, I find a lot of entrepreneurs, and I'm guilty of it too, as product people, you're very, you have to be so positive about what it is that you're building. So do you find that sometimes it's just making product people understand, well, hey, you may want this audience or you may have this belief, but bidding on those keywords or going for that audience is a lot harder than going for this, who we also have as an audience. Is it much that, like, educating them on those components?
Completely. I mean, I think many marketers in the industry face this similar, you know, question of frustration sometimes around, you know, we're all consumers, we all consume marketing. And so then you can very easily, you know, make inferences around how to therefore do it. And I think a marketer's role often is to take those inputs, but then have an educational lens internally. And that translates to how you speak to your customers as well, that you need to make sure that you're leading with why and what the trade-offs are to meet that goal. And something that I think about a lot is we've reached quite a turning point, I think, in the marketing industry today, where you can measure anything. You can you can tie yourself in knots with this language of ROAS and CAC and ROI and CPCs and, you know, like, listeners now are probably, you know, hating hearing you know, me rattle off all these acronyms because it's frustrating. But I think that there are rabbit holes that you can go down, you know, within your teams and within your businesses about how much there is to do in marketing. And so I think framing conversations internally with a lens of, you know, something that one of our best leaders said to me one time in a leadership forum that we did back in APAC was this idea of, does it make the boat go faster? It's something that sporting teams have used. This was a rowing team in particular in the lead up to the Olympic Games. And when there was so much to do and so much pressure and so many decisions to make, their team had this mantra of, does it make the boat go faster? If it does, great, let's do it. If we're not sure, let's not. That's a principle that I think about a lot when there's many different ways that we could be slicing a marketing campaign. Yeah. If the objective is app downloads, if the objective is leads, if the objective is brand awareness, great. Let's all rally around that and make sure that everyone can see that and is bought into that idea and we have the right strategies and funding to do it.
So you mentioned APAC. What were the sort of differences between Australia and US when it comes to marketing culture? Like, the old cliche is that the US is ahead of Australia generally by a few years. I think that idea is becoming less and less when it comes to marketing, simply because everything is now digital, or most things are digital. Is there anything that really stands out there to you?
It does. Look, I was navigating this new, you know, cultural environment, living in and working in. I was 22 at the time and hadn't actually been to the US really before, well, at all, and until I'd worked for Uber, and so was really thrown in the deep end from a cultural perspective. And also the team I went into was always a global team. So the way that we structured both the team that I sat in for Uber Eats in San Francisco and then marketing operations in New York were always global. And so that meant that you were sitting in the US physically and you were surrounded culturally by that environment. But my stakeholders every day were in Amsterdam and Mexico City and right. Singapore. And so the marketing application there was that I constantly had to be aware of our global brand and how we showed up, and reinforced to me that your brand and your product is only actually in the eyes of the people who are using it on the ground. And you can, you know, come up with whatever positioning or creative guidelines or anything at an HQ level, but it's inherently going to be socialized on the ground and be socialized within a culture and within a zeitgeist that, you don't, you know, necessarily have the final hand in. And so that to me was fascinating, but I think a really good, you know, reality check about how markets move across the world and also within a large US company, how the US market is viewed in relation to other parts of the business too.
Yeah. How is it viewed in relation to other parts of the business?
I mean, it's the biggest part of the business for a company like Uber. Yeah. So naturally, you know, you get an over-indexation of resources and focus. So that's completely understandable. I think, you know, the way that the culture translates, the way that the brand translates, takes a lot of work to get that right when you're operating at that scale. But something, for example, we prioritized and did on our team was actually split our US marketing team and our global marketing team. And that doesn't sounds pretty intuitive, but it was actually quite an interesting way to structure things, because generally within these marketing structures, you would have a slashy US slash global team that when a Super Bowl campaign was happening, when Coachella was happening, that team had to focus on that. They weren't thinking about you in Europe who needed assets and was committed a strategy and was expecting something from global. So by splitting that out, our team truly functioned as an in-house agency to the mega regions. Yeah. Our stakeholders, our clients almost, were these leads around all of the regions. And so it really forced you to focus on that and not be so tuned into exactly what's happening in the actual country and in which you're living and working.
So I think you've spent, you can correct me if I'm wrong, like about 7 years post-uni working. Is that about right?
Less.
So
because of the overlap, you know, post-uni, it's only been about 3 years. I'm 24 now, but spent, a full 2 years of work experience, 2.5 years of work experience in marketing.
While at uni. So you, in a way, you've boiled a few years down together, which is good. You've been able to condense a lot of learning in a short period of time. Are there key principles now that you're at Mr. Yum that are non-negotiables for you amongst a team? How do you view marketing and your job today as a marketer at Mr. Yum?
So the shift has been, you know, one of the largest shifts into this role has been that shift from B2C to B2B. Which has been really, you know, foundational for me in understanding a product and sales led business versus a very direct response marketing business. That's been fascinating, and I think a learning there is to understand your role and understand where you can add value to the end customer. So I mean, principle number one, you know, marketing 101 is know the customer and know what makes them tick and how to reach them. But something that I kind of apply on top of that and speak with my team about is, as we're working out how to grow and scale, is always give value before you ask for something. And if you do that, then you'll probably be in a pretty good position.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, as marketers, we're asking people to do something that they're not currently doing. We're asking them to click something, download something, get off the couch, spend money. And I think a pretty good way to start that conversation is giving something of value. So at Mr. Yum, something that we talk a lot about in our content strategy is that no one gives you a manual to be a venue manager. It's an incredibly difficult job. It's something that requires you to simultaneously be a marketer, an accountant, you know, a recruiter, HR, and, you know, everything else under the sun. And if we can exist to upfront be able to give resources about how to navigate your liquor license, how to think about your Instagram strategy, how to, you know, set yourself up for success in the industry, yes, you know, we see Mr. Yum as part of that down the line. But when you're just starting the conversation, giving that value upfront gives you a much better footing to start that on.
So what are the key marketing channels for you guys? Like, if you look at your day-to-day, you're back in the office now, you rock up in the morning, I'm sure you've checked your emails before you actually get into work, yeah, guys. But what are the
Slack.
Yeah, Slack and whatnot. What are the key things that you're looking at? What are the spreadsheets? What are the channels? What are you doing?
really timely question right now, and we're pretty excited about how things are structured. Our team at the moment, so I joined Mistium 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah.
To lead the function, which had design and content production at its core.
Okay.
At Mistium, there is an exceptional amount of marketing literacy because of everyone's startup backgrounds. So you're dealing in an environment where everyone set up Facebook ads, everyone set up Google ads, everyone sent email automations. And so that is kind of, that's nothing new to the business. So coming in, the first hire that I've made is a digital marketing manager. And so the way that we work right now is we've kind of brought the duo of myself and the content producer up to this trio where we have this really nice connection between the content that we're producing, the channels we want that to go on, and we're working in growth sprints effectively.
Okay.
So we're thinking of structuring what we're doing in marketing and digital right now, and this is speaking just to the digital part of what we're doing in terms of, you know, let's tackle these types of lead gen campaigns. Let's work out if LinkedIn's the channel for us. Let's work out if Google Ads the channel for us. You know, what are some of the smaller areas that we can also start to experiment with and see what sticks. And so on a weekly cadence, that's how you'll find us working at the moment, to be testing and iterating on those traction channels and finding, you know, finding how that works.
I think speaking to Zoe last month from July, there's a very similar thing happening. I noticed this amongst a lot of challenger brands is that it seems like you guys are owning more and more of the creative component. Like you said, you've got this very strong content ethos internally. What are you then leaning on outside agencies for more and more?
Right now, we're not working with any agencies. I think agencies are such a fundamental part to the marketing industry, and the way that I've best worked with agencies is when we've had a really clear brief that there's been something really specific to go out to them with. And right now, the amount of ideas we have, the pace that we're working at, the amount that we're able to hire to meet those goals as well, we've been able to keep this functioning in-house. I think things like PR, we've had really great success with, you know, working with external partners. But the way that we're looking at it right now is to make sure that we can run as fast as we can at all the ideas that we already have, and then be able to look up for a second at what ideas we might be missing. And I think that's where an agency can really come in.
Right. So you think looking at it more from a big ideas perspective as opposed to scaling it. Because I think what Zoe said is she was looking at it from, and these are very different businesses. Mm. You're talking about a B2B business versus her, which is B2C. Hers was all about scaling production because their issue is that they need to make more content because they've just got more eyeballs and more people. But, you know, it's very different in an organization where it's about more depth, so to speak, because you're dealing with less people and you're trying to get down to a deeper level with them.
Exactly.
So that's very interesting. So maybe in future for B2B businesses, it's about engaging agencies, at least at a challenger level. For those bigger ideas, what that looks like, I don't know.
Exactly. And I think it's, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, internal skill sets versus external skill sets and where you draw those lines. And so I think, you know, one example is SEO specialists or, you know, SEO writing specialists, copywriters. There might be opportunities where, you know, there's specific briefs that go out to a specific person that we find or someone who can do, you know, X outputs per month or X outputs per week and kind of have a really clear scope like that.
Mm.
The most successful way that I've worked with agencies, you know, longer term on more of a retained relationship is when that person's very embedded in your team, that they're almost at your team meetings and part of everything that you're doing. And so I think for us at Mistium, we're at that point where the speed and velocity that we're trying things can't quite match to having an external, you know, party involved in that. And I think for the right partner, it does, but hasn't been a focus. And so I think some of those parallels I do see with how we built things at Uber Eats as well. You know, early on, it was us running at a lot of things, slowly brought on an influencer agency because we didn't have that skill set and connections in-house, slowly brought on PR agencies because we didn't have that skill set in-house. And then by the time I left the business in Australia, that was when we had the first iterations of tonight I'll be eating Hitting Market.
Yeah.
And I'll, you know, put our hand up and say that I don't think that the idea of Sophie Monk sitting on a couch talking about what she's going to have for dinner was going to come from our team meeting that week. That, you know, that was a genius creative director's idea from a great agency. And so I think it's that exciting tipping point that you get where you're ready to tap into an external voice on your business and being able to then have the team internally that whatever they come up with, you can execute on really successfully.
Who was that? Because I know Dan Monheit said to me, I asked him, who were the independent agencies that you really respect? It's a Kiwi agency. They've got Australian partners and they came up with that campaign. Do you know the name of the...
Special Group in Sydney? Yeah. And Special Group, look, they've had an amazing ride with this campaign. It's now in Tokyo and in the US as well.
Massive.
You know, as part of the Super Bowl this year. So yeah, being in that room when that idea was conceived was pretty cool. And again, I think really was an experience that helped me understand what an agency's role is.
Mm. Yeah, it was a great campaign. I think it just launched in the US with Mark Hamill and the guy who plays the brainy dude from X-Men. I just can't remember his name. The old bald
Patrick
bloke.
Patrick Stewart.
That's it.
Yes, Mark Hamill, Patrick Stewart.
What's the thing that they fucking argue over? That I hate the... I don't hate the ad. It drives me nuts, but it's also a good ad.
And tomato, tomato, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Classic.
Tomato, tomato. Anyway, I'm getting distracted on that. So, marketing progression. I'm curious now. I can't believe you're 24, by the way. Like, I thought, wow, okay, very mature, very switched on. You obviously, most marketers go through this whole maturity process. I think I put in the notes that I know, at least for me personally, you go through this whole stage of, in the early days, it's the basics of understanding web and pay-per-click and social and all that sort of stuff. And then you get to a point of understanding more targeted work and data becomes everything. And then you get to that sort of CMO level where I don't know whether you start thinking more about brand marketing because you've got so many touch points. Like I remember having a conversation with, was it Hyundai? Because we were talking to them about a podcast. And the guy told me he had something like 89 different channels that they were measuring. So to me, he was like, look, like at the end of the day, things become like in basis points. Like, you know, was our ROAS 8.12 this week or was it 8.68? Like that's the sort of level that they're looking at. For you personally, in your own learning, what do you think in the last year has helped impact you the most? Is a particular resource? Is it doing something in particular? What is it?
So I've learned two completely different jobs from scratch in the last 12 months. So this time last year was when I stepped into the global marketing operations team at Uber, and that was we were essentially the chief of staff team to our CMO. So that was getting into finance meetings of a public company and talking through line by line the marketing P&L at a global level, including headcount and the implications on that. And so a lot to learn there in terms of like, you know, the inner workings of quarterly reporting in a public company. Fast forward all the way to taking this role as head of marketing at Mr. Yum and needing to understand that landscape and being in a B2B world, you know, being in an earlier stage startup too. So I always by default just consult the great minds around me. I've had the privilege to always be in the rooms where the people have the answer. Mm. And I think about that, you know, in terms of let's ask someone who probably knows and start there and then just do your own research to supplement that. You know, you mentioned YouTube videos and learning online, like especially with digital marketing, everything is on YouTube.
Yeah.
And it's incredible and it really can cause so many light bulb moments. The biggest like light bulb moment for me recently and the biggest learning opportunity has actually been reflecting on the amount of rooms I had sat in pre-Mr. Yum thinking, I'm not an email marketer. I don't know how to build a website. Huh. I've never done display advertising. I've never done XYZ. And you kind of, you build up this whole narrative of all the things that you haven't had exposure to do in your job. You know, you've done it with friends' businesses and you've done it freelance or you found ways to learn. But thinking that in your job, you actually might not know how or have the skills to do it, to come into an environment at Mr. Yum where we're trying lots of stuff and, you know, I have the trust of our founders to do that and get on the tools and start trying things, you're a better email marketer than you think. You're a better web designer than you think. You're a better, you know, copywriter than you think. And so at the end of the day, I do think that getting thrown into new things is the way that I learn.
Yeah.
And you might not be the best specialist in the world at it at the time that you're doing it, but you can do a good job. And if you know your marketing principles about measurement and attribution and targeting, you can get a pretty good read out of if that's working or not.
Yeah, I can't underline the attribution component enough. We had a pitch recently where unfortunately the agency didn't get the attribution right and it can cause absolute havoc. It's funny you mention the family stuff. I'm curious because we, you know, you run an agency, you get requests from friends and family to do things. Lauren's mum runs a B&B on the peninsula that we're always doing little things for. And someone asked me the other day about a logo. We do no logo design. But I know as soon as I send them to who we refer people for our branding and logos and stuff like that, like it'll be like 10, 15 grand for something like that. So it's absolutely ridiculous to send them there. What's the funniest thing that you've had to help someone with in the last couple of years?
So one I actually did, a friend of mine started a podcast over lockdown. Jeff's a good mate of mine from uni, and him and Isabella have started a podcast called As I Am, where they're looking at the experience of being an Asian Australian in Australia. And they built the brand and they started to build episodes and were looking for some help on marketing exactly at the time that I was going into hotel quarantine, coming back from New York. And so, look, it was a lifesaver for me as much as it was marketing help for them that I could, you know, sit in this hotel room. And I was working remotely for Uber at the time, so basically doing a nocturnal work day, and then I'd get to jump on and chat marketing with them.
Yeah.
And it was a great experience. They had a good designer working with them and had built all the branding from scratch and got to have a bit of fun playing that consulting role and talking a bit about social and how they could start to get traction.
Yeah. I can see you as a bit of a workaholic. Am I right in saying that?
I love my work.
Yeah.
I do. And look, it's behavior that's been, you know, modeled and reinforced to me from my family for sure. You know, we've all, you know, worked pretty hard for the time that we have. And so I love it. And I think that's the difference for me at Mr. Yum and the work that I'm doing right now. Like on your busiest day, you bloody love what you're doing and you're speaking to venues. You know that you're really helping them to make their numbers work and be sustainable, you know, coming out of the year that we've had. And so that's really the only guide that I need to know that I'm in the right place.
What do your parents do out of interest?
Yeah, so my mum's in HR. So she's always been in pretty senior HR roles and that people side of business is, you know, it's relentless. There's always something to do. Dad's an architect by trade. And then has been more in like public engineering circles more recently. Mum actually didn't go to uni and ended up shifting from being a hairdresser to then retraining and going into HR. So I think that's always something that nice for me to have seen that, you know, there's always an ability to retrain and rethink about your career. But
yeah.
Really, really incredible role models for me in terms of work ethic and navigating business too. I think I've always really known the value of having that business acumen and understanding things like HR and hiring and accounting and how all those functions work.
Yeah, it'd be the conversations you guys have at dinner tables at night, which would impact you. For me, it was just sitting in, like, because Dad has a factory, he's a printer. So I always find that sometimes you don't realize, but it's just indirect things that you see, maybe when you're in your parents' office or something like that. But for me, it was like little things of being in the factory, smelling paper. I still get a thing for like freshly printed paper.
It's going to stick with you.
It's going to stick with me forever. Before we get into trends, at Mr. Yum, let's say tomorrow you were off to another business and it was in a totally different area, like B2C or e-commerce or something like that. What do you think would be the principles that you pull from Mr. Yum that then work with you in another landscape?
It's a good question based on how, you know, early it is for me still in the environment there. But it's definitely made a huge impact already of, you know, on me as a person and as a marketer. I think the experimental nature of what we're doing at Mr. Yum has been incredible to see. And I think something that will now be with me. So that idea of let's do it and have a bias for action and done is better than perfect. I think that's exactly kind of the kick that I needed at the stage that I'm at in my career. And so if that was to be translated, you know, somewhere new, I think that's something that I always want to preserve. I was even, we're doing some work on our mantras at the moment, and we were reading up on the Spotify mantras and kind of business principles and values. And it's a fascinating read because they're such a huge company, but when you get into how they run their business, they've tried so hard to preserve the startup nature of how they do business and having no time for bureaucracy and politics and, leading by, commitment versus consensus and all these principles that, you know, I haven't worked for Spotify. I don't know the inside of it, but I hadn't seen a company of that size recently that had actually still had down on paper that that's what they're trying to do. And I think kind of bottling that from how we work at Mr. Yum and trying to preserve it is something that I'll always keep.
Yeah, and I think as well, one thing you'll probably get to realize after working in hospitality is that service element as well. Like there was things that you were mentioning before and the way that you guys think about the content that you make, it's really like above and beyond what you would expect. And I often find that when people go from B2B space into B2C, they're often, I don't know, maybe there's something about B2B making you more in tune with the customer because they're living, breathing people you speak to all the time and have way more engaging relationships with. Whereas B2C, just by the nature of it, there's more people. So, I wonder whether that will be a component of as well. But trends. Last 24 months has been interesting, obviously dominated by COVID. We've got new platforms, TikTok just working with the talent here. And today, we can say today, it was Facebook pulled the news.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see some major shifts in platforms. What won't change for you and what will change for you, do you think, over the next 12 months?
I think what won't change just culturally, everyone is going to always remember, but for marketers, we'll definitely remember that coming off 2020, you've just got to be highly aware that we exist within a culture and a world that we can't control. And so I believe that marketing teams and businesses should have plans, they should have content calendars, they should, you know, be making commitments, but baking in flexibility to that is going to be important. And I don't see that changing after the year we've had. You know, anyone on a social media team in particular, I think will have that relationship with their content calendar now that they know if something happens in the world, they're not making that post. And it doesn't matter how much you spent on it, it doesn't matter what media buy you've locked in. Sometimes we're not going to be able to do things. And so I think building your marketing teams around that ethos, I think will be very grounding for marketers moving forward and just honestly help us stay sane and appreciate that everything you say yes to might have some risk, but that doesn't mean you don't do it. It just means that you understand
flexibility. Yeah, I think just on that, I distinctly remember this when I first found Gary Vee back in like 2011 or something like that. And he spoke about, obviously, everyone remembers the terrorist attacks that happened in Paris. And I remember he said like a few months beforehand, people should not be too obsessed. Brands should not be too obsessed with their scheduling because there will be, or particularly personal brands, they shouldn't be too obsessed with it because there will be events that happen in the world that you just cannot control. And back then in 2011, we were nowhere near as agile as what we are marketing-wise today. And I just remember seeing on Twitter like these scheduled tweets amongst all these other people tweeting about what was happening in Paris, and it did look incredibly tone deaf. And so it goes to the point that COVID really did accelerate that point that you were mentioning before in this year, because you just had to be completely engrossed in your calendar on what was
exactly
going on.
And look, even pre-COVID, something that I've always respected, and I've heard many marketers talk about it before, is this idea that no one likes the person at the party that's just talking about themselves. And as a brand, that's really important to remember that you can decide whatever you want to decide in your marketing meeting about what you're going to say that week or that month. But if you end up not being relevant, or there's actually nothing to say, or, you know, you don't have the content for it that week, that's okay. And I think the world would prefer that, you know, you don't rustle up something just to meet your content calendar. And you reserve that for when you really do have something to say. And finding that relevance is hard, because I think there's a lot of pressure, especially in a consumer marketing role, that you should be saying something for Halloween, you should be saying something for Valentine's Day, you should be wishing your customers Happy New Year, you should be doing Mother's Day and Father's Day, and every single thing on the calendar you could and should be relevant, and maybe you are, but I think that lens of kind of finding your voice can be a really good principle.
Yeah.
Just to make a bigger splash with the things that you are doing, and also keep yourself sane and not be kind of as tied to a calendar.
There was someone who did an interview recently with, well, she's done a few interviews with Tim Ferriss, and she's a well-known graphic designer / agency owner. And she literally spoke about this the other week. It's spending less time sometimes on visibility and more time on execution, which goes to what you said, because a lot of people in our industry spend a lot of time on telling people how great they are versus doing great things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would 100% agree with that. And that's a battle that I've had to deal with, because I remember at the start of the year, I'm like, I'm going to do a video a week on our YouTube channel. It's going to be this, it's going to be that. And then I realized, you know what? It'd actually be better if I just wrote for 4 weeks in a row about this specific topic or a bunch of topics, and then let my brain think about it, and then finally record a video like once a month, and have far more impact than just pushing shit out for the sake of it.
Yeah.
And how many people will see it?
And often when you're, you know, I know for me personally, I often impose these deadlines and ideas on myself.
No one's asked, you're
probably the same. You know, no one's asked you to record a video a week. No one said you have to do this number of podcasts or this number of slide decks or take this many clients. But we want to be successful and we want to work hard. And so you end up biting off more than you can chew sometimes. And
yeah,
it's good
A-type individuals will have that. It's a double-edged sword. It means you can push through the anxiety and the stress more, except when you stop, you just feel it way more, I'd say. So opposing that on what won't change, what do you think will change over the coming 12 months?
Well, I mean, as you said, with this Facebook news, you know, this morning, we've also got digital marketers in a flap about iOS 14 right now. I think where we are at this inflection point around how we use platforms, what data is actually ours, what is in our toolkit that we can rely on and use and do, and ways that we can spend our money, versus what are things that are, you know, actually someone else's, or someone could very easily take away from us, or force us to diversify. And so I think what will change is everyone having to spend, you know, maybe even more time than they have done previously, being aware of that and looking at what all the platforms are up to and what's on their roadmaps and how it might affect you. And as part of that, always just thinking about diversification. And I think that's obviously, that's in opposition to this idea of finding your traction channels, which is going to be hard to balance because, you know, you mentioned a CMO who has 89 campaigns and channels going. I think people, you know, we don't want to work like that. We want to find out, is it SEM, email, and LinkedIn? Great. Let's just do that.
Yeah.
But if you've picked the wrong three channels, unfortunately, and, you know, now there's platform changes, then you might be stuck. And so I think it's trying to balance that idea of simplification and finding your core channels with diversification. And I think that is going to be something that marketers need to think about. And I hope that the end goal is a much more simple customer-centric view, you know, again, in many ways. I think we've been through this evolution of going really deep on platforms, on measurement, on testing, and that will always be, you know, principles for marketing. But I think it's we've tied ourselves in knots in some ways. And so zooming out is going to be important.
I think with the iOS 14 thing, it's going to be interesting. I think people are freaking out more maybe because they don't understand it than they should. I mean, we just set up, I'm probably sure you've done it as well, you basically, like Facebook's workaround is you get the code and you put it in your header or what was the other options they had? There's some sort of installation on the code base itself. And that will take time for so many marketers to do that. It'll probably take a couple of years till we get back to that picture of what is going on. There's the fact that, you know, on mobiles, you're going to have to opt into things and people worry about people not opting in. But I think by and large, you probably will because I don't want, I've had the experience, I was off, you know, Google, how you can block them from identify, it's a very hard setting to find, but you can block them from basically identifying you as an individual based on your search history.
Yes, yeah, so they so just I give did, you the blanket search rather than personalized.
And I got to say, the ads are dog shit in comparison. And I've just gone back to it because I was sick of getting ads for plus 500 and then a pregnancy thing on YouTube or like the display ad was like buying gold rings or something like that because they had no idea who I was. It's actually a bad, it's a worse user experience. I get where people are coming from where they're scared about the data component. So I think it just means that because of that, there'll be more, like you said, platforms that aren't as, they're still digital, but I think like influencers and PR will probably become a little bit more important. I've noticed that just based on the inbound queries because you're going to need to have someone who's bought into an audience of someone else because those audiences supposedly are going to be harder to target in the long run. Whether that's true, I don't really know.
And
no
we're
one
all
knows
just,
yet.
We're all going to just be left with our first party audience. So exactly as you say, you know, an influencer has their audience, you know, a press publication has their readers, a business has their customers, and maybe we'll be operating in more of a space where you just need to go directly to the source.
Yeah.
I think something that I find, you know, humbling and important to think about too is as I've been reaching out to my networks and to see what they think about iOS 14, I got a text back from Nico, who used to head up our Europe social business. And he said, look, this feels very reminiscent of when GDPR was coming out.
Yeah.
We thought it was the end of marketing. Everyone freaked out, but we found a way. And so I think that's really the spirit of it for me as well, that these things are incredibly technical and complicated and very hard to get any sense out of Facebook or Apple or anyone else. But if you can kind of, if you can do your research and be optimistic and know that there's a way out of it, everything will be okay.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it does. That's such a, fuck, that's such an accurate assessment. GDPR, yeah. Fuck, those are the days. I was like, you're going to get fined based on this quote in the legislation. You're going to be fined $1 million. And it's like, yeah, how are they going to monitor that? Plus, it's very easy to fix up. You just have to have it. And everyone expects it now.
Exactly. In people get used, people adapt. Humans are amazing.
Yeah. Mads, thank you so much for coming in. Where can people find you on the interwebs and see what you're up to?
LinkedIn is great. I'm not going to say Clubhouse because we're not sure yet if that's, you know, taking off. I'm lurking on there but haven't participated.
What's your thoughts on Clubhouse just quickly?
Oh, it's fascinating. Who knows yet? I think the audio only component makes complete sense after the Zoom fatigue that everyone's experiencing.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that there's zero prep. Everyone's just kind of come as you are, say what you have to say. But I'm just fascinated to see like how exclusive it becomes or is maintained as, or if it really just becomes another house party or something that you're creating chat rooms versus being a networking space.
Yeah, I can't see the networking component other than when it gives you the options to invite people and people are like, oh my God, thank you so much. I wanted to be on Clubhouse. It's like, yeah, there's some, you know, brownie points there. But like, I haven't seen anything that really tells me that this has got that network effect yet.
Not yet. Still waiting to see.
Yeah, I'm still waiting to see. So not Clubhouse. What about Mr. Yum?
Mr. Yum. So we're Mr. Yum, MRYUM across all of our socials. And on LinkedIn as well. So that's the best place to find me. I'm Mads Hallett on everything. Always happy to chat to marketers, to people in the hospitality industry. We love picking up the phone and having a chat at Mr. Yum. So that always works.
We'll link all of that, but thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.